Hello, friends. Welcome to the Book Spider Podcast, an informative program that really could cover any topic related to the arts that you can imagine. My name is Patrick Barney, and I'm joined by my friends Hans Berger and Chris Malmberg. We're the three regular hosts of this podcast, so, you know, longtime listeners will know who we are. If this is your first time, you know, you're in for a treat because we're all really cool cats. So today we're going to talk about what I hope is a pretty interesting question. And that question is, are aesthetic properties real or just made up? So if we put this in a less philosophical way, the question is this. When we talk about art, books, movies, literature, songs, can our opinions about that art be true or false, or are they just that, opinions? Now, are asking are aesthetic properties real and can our opinions be true or false isn't exactly the same question, but I'm assuming that we understand the connection that we probably can't believe that our opinions about art are true or false if aesthetic properties aren't real, if they're subjective or you know, just non-existent. So, but hopefully this is an interesting topic and we can really get into it. To facilitate this discussion, we've read two articles in The Philosophy of Aesthetics, Real Beauty by Eddie Zemach, and, or it could be Edie. I don't know if the person who wrote Real Beauty is a man or a woman, but Edie or Eddie is possible. And then Realism About Aesthetic Properties by Alan Goldman. Real Beauty takes the position that aesthetic properties are real, and that's Zemach. And then Realism About Aesthetic Properties by Goldman takes the position that they are not real. So realist versus anti-realist stances. After we discuss the kind of the main arguments of these articles, we're going to apply their concepts to the film LFO, a dark and disturbing Swedish, it's described as a comedy, but maybe it's like maybe a horror comedy, maybe a thriller comedy. I'm not exactly sure, but I mean, horror comedy seems okay. It's pretty disturbing at times. So let me start by summarizing the main arguments of Real Beauty and Realism About Aesthetic Properties. Zemach in Real Beauty has two main arguments in favor of aesthetic realism. First, he argues that aesthetic relativism, or I'm actually going to say aesthetic anti-realism rather than relativism because those are a little different. First, he argues that aesthetic anti-realism makes a discussion of aesthetic properties impossible. So here it is in a syllogistic form. I'm not a professional philosopher, so I did my best to kind of put it as a syllogism, though there might be some enthymemes that would need to be teased out if we really wanted to make it a true syllogism. So, A, relativists, anti-realists must hold that art critics do not speak about actual artistic objects, but rather subjective perceptions of artistic objects. That's premise A. Premise B, if art critics are speaking about subjective perceptions of artistic objects, then they cannot know if their aesthetic terms reference the same properties. And the reason that is because if two art critics could believe that they see the same artistic object as Gaudi, but if they're both responding to two distinct perceptions of the artistic object, not the same artistic object, they could be using the term Gaudi in two totally different ways. Therefore, the conclusion C, anti-realists are committed to a position that makes discussion of artistic objects impossible, which Zemach takes to be patently false. Another argument that Zemeck offers is an analogy to scientific realism. He says that the main criteria we use for scientific theoretical goodness are actually aesthetic. And a scientific theory is more likely to be true if it is simple, powerful, and dramatic, all of which are aesthetic properties. Hence, if scientific realism is correct, which Zemeck thinks it is, aesthetic realism is also correct. So those are the two main arguments for aesthetic realism. Goldman responds to these with his own arguments in favor of anti-realism. First, he says that realists have to admit that relational evaluations are present in any realist conception of aesthetic properties. So he compares this to colors, which are real, but which only occur because of physical laws involving the shape of surface molecules, lengths of light waves, and the mechanisms of human eyesight. So the reason why a typically sighted person has a red experience when they see a light wave of a certain length is because they have typically operating rods and cones in their eyes, right? So Goldman says, we're thus able to say that a color is objectively red because it appears that way to ideal observers. And a person with red-green color blindness would be an example of someone who is a non-ideal observer. However, Goldman believes that we're unable to point to objective aesthetic properties because disagreements about these properties persist through artistic training, making identification of an ideal aesthetic observer hard to come by. Next, Goldman also says that Zemeck's analogy to scientific realism is unwarranted. Judging a scientific theory's truthfulness by things like simplicity, power, and drama are not actually that similar to aesthetic judgments. Scientific simplicity, for example, is quite different from aesthetic simplicity. Goldman also argues that we can more or less say that the scientific explanations that seem best to us are those that are made under favorable conditions, and therefore we don't need to reference aesthetics at all when judging the truth of scientific theory. So those are kind of the main arguments of these two philosophical articles. I also want to introduce a couple of other terms that I think are important. So in another article by Goldman, an article titled Aesthetic Qualities and Aesthetic Value, the concept of artistic merit is introduced, which is a more general term than most aesthetic qualities. So for example, beauty is an aesthetic quality that artistic works may have, but it's you can't use it nearly as widely as the term artistic merit. So I want to introduce the term artistic merit just because I think it's probably like a better term for a more general discussion that we're going to have. Like, I assume we're not going to get down into the nitty gritty of aesthetic properties per se. We're more interested in just whether or not they are objective, if they exist factually, and less in like the difference between beauty and gaudiness. So artistic merit seems like a useful term for us to use. I also wanted to point out that in another article by author Louise Hansen, Moral Realism, Aesthetic Realism, and the Asymmetry Claim, Hansen points out that statements of this form make complete sense. I do not enjoy artistic work A, but I believe it has artistic merit. So that also seems like an important concept for us to use. And I don't think I need to explain that much, except that, you know, I'll probably get into it as our discussion proceeds. So before we get into our questions, do either of you guys have any questions of your own, like things that didn't make sense in the readings? I know we don't usually do this, but these readings are different, you know, and I guess I'm the one who should probably try to be the person of authority here. So if you guys didn't understand something, or if you want me to clear something up, I'm happy to oblige, or we could just go right into the questions, whatever you want.
Well, I don't know if I would say this is something that, I don't know if this is an issue of something making sense or not making sense exactly, but like Goldman's article, ZMAX, the first one was ZMAX, right? ZMAX idea about scientific realism and how scientific theories are evaluated. Is that true? That just, I thought scientific theories were evaluated through replicability, testability. Yeah. Like this idea that that just seemed like complete bullshit to me. Is it? And I know we're not scientists here, but like, I feel like I'm not to like get hostile right out of the gate, but that I just was mystified by that whole idea. And I was just wondering, Patrick, you're a lot more familiar with philosophy than I am. Are these like widely accepted ideas in the philosophy of science? Is this something that like drug researchers are considering? I don't know, like it.
No, I think that the idea that simplicity, power, and drama are, these are, I think it is widely accepted that things like the simplicity and the explanatory power of a scientific theory, it is widely accepted that those are, yes, those are things that you want your theory to have. Like if we have, let's say we have two scientific theories that explain the same thing just as well, but one is simpler, then we like the simpler one more. Does that make sense?
It does. It just seems to me like that, again, as not an expert, it seems to me like there would be a lot of other things that would be of greater value in evaluating which scientific theory or hypothesis was correct, right? Like,
sure.
Because, you know,
one of you mentioned repeatability. That certainly seems like a thing that, you know, if you can repeat a scientific test over and over and it gets the same results, then that also is a thing that lends it credibility, right?
Yeah.
So it could be that while ZMAX not necessarily bullshitting here, it could be that the argument is not as good as it needs to be. That could be true.
I guess it's like a two-stage objection, right? Like first, I'm not sure how much his ideas actually describe the practice of science as such,
which is something that Goldman says.
And then second, even if his ideas do describe the practice of science, I'm not really sure that I'm not moved by the idea that the relationship between the evaluation of scientific theories and the evaluation of aesthetics. He seems to kind of take the connection as obvious in a way that on a personal level, I'm somewhat sympathetic to ZMAX's theses, right? Like, I'm reasonably sympathetic to his ideas, or her. I think it feels masculine to me. Maybe I'm wrong. I'm reasonably sympathetic to ZMAX's ideas. I don't find the actual arguments, to the extent that they're discernible, I don't find them particularly convincing. But I guess, I just wanted to make sure I was understanding the science, the aspect of science as it's used there correctly. Yeah. And it sounds like I am.
I think that was a good question. Yes, I think simplicity and explanatory power, drama, like he uses the word drama. I'm less familiar with that, but simplicity and explanatory power are definitely things that, philosophers of science think are important in judging a scientific theory's truthfulness.
And explanatory power I can certainly see, right? Simplicity right. seems a bit... I mean, simplicity, I understand why simplicity might be helpful in initially determining which of a set of theories to look into further, but, like, ultimately, if a complicated theory... I don't know. It just seems like complicated. If a complicated theory has more explanatory power, then the question of simplicity has to
right.
be secondary.
Right.
And,
like,
and drama just yeah, seems like complete bullshit.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I kind of agree with your take, Hans. I think that I feel more sympathy to Zemach's argument. But I think this specifically, the scientific theory one, isn't that good.
Right.
In contrast, I also think Goldman's arguments are pretty bad, too, to be honest. I don't think either article presents a strong case for either side to be real. Did you want to tune in too, Chris, or chime in?
Like, yeah, I you know, maybe Goldman's is a little bit suffering because he's responding to Zemach, you know, and so like,
right.
So, because I get, I'm pulling from the Goldman article here. I'm pretty lost in where both articles start talking about like objective versus evaluative terms. So I think I understand that like something is red for empirical reasons, and then Zemach goes into like how important it is to, you know, not force people to avoid, you know, the subjective sort of description of red. And Goldman kind of jumps into that space too. Being gaudy and vivid and bold may involve identical objective constituent properties, and that is why these properties can be the focus of critical disagreements, but in the absence of full paradigms, grounding to common objective components will be sufficient to make aesthetic property terms comprehensible if the evaluative... And
sure.
Yeah, like that
yeah, I mean,
that is
thick.
Pretty hard for me. Like, I was really lost.
That's thick, hard language.
Yeah. So... that's where I think that maybe just like talking and answering your questions will kind of get to some of those.
Sure.
Some of those, because I think I have a picture of a piece of what they are talking about each in turn, but it feels very mushy.
Right.
And it may actually be, it could be my understanding, or it could actually be the actual material of their argument. So,
right. So, so just to maybe to help clear things up, I'll just kind of explain my position, and maybe me talking will give you greater clarity, Chris, or you, Hans, and we can see what happens from there. We already talked a little about how maybe the analogy to scientific realism isn't that great. Maybe, you know, and I think that, you know, when it's hard to explain exactly why, but I do feel when Goldman says towards the end of his paper that scientific simplicity and power are not quite the same thing as aesthetic simplicity and power. It's hard to explain why, but I feel like maybe he's right there. Like, it seems like simplicity of a scientific theory is not aesthetic. Does that make sense? Like, I know I'm not offering an explanation for why, but would you say that, like, that gut reaction is your reaction as well or not?
I would say that gut reaction is my reaction. I mean, I don't think that you can, I don't think the default position should be these two things are identical unless proven otherwise, right? The default position should be these two things are different unless they are compellingly explained to be linked. There's no compelling, that I was able to find, like, there's no compelling explanation of that link. In the absence thereof, they should be treated as separate things.
Agreed.
Yeah, okay. So we're all agreed there. That's a good explanation, Hans. And so I think Zemach's argument on that side probably isn't that great. His other argument is... And Chris, you pointed out that Goldman's response to Zemach's first argument about how it's impossible to discuss if anti-realism were true or subjectivism about aesthetic properties were true, Zemach says that we wouldn't actually be able to discuss artistic objects. And then Goldman's response, as you pointed out, Chris, is mushy. And I'm actually going to say that I think that is a fault on Goldman's part. I understand. I'm not totally sure that I agree with Zemach, but I understand his argument where he says, like, premise A and B, like, you're talking about two different things. You're not actually talking about the artistic object. You're talking about two different perceptions of the objects. And if that's true, then your aesthetic terms might reference different things. Therefore, our discussion of artistic objects would be impossible if the anti-realist is correct. Like, that at least is an argument I understand. And maybe it's not correct, but Goldman's response is mushy and doesn't, I don't know that he's saying much, to be honest. So I guess I give the point to Zemach on the first argument, even if I'm not sure that Zemach's argument is like the takedown that it should be.
Yeah, I'll weigh in really quickly if you don't mind, because, like, I'm just reading my notes here. I wrote pretty early in the Zemach article, bullshit. We influence the internality of others all the time. Like, basically, like, pain being an incredibly subjective experience, like, Zemach says that, like, it's very impossible to come to, like, an objective sort of, like, shared experience of pain. But
right,
and I think that that's true. But in talking about our own pain, we do create a pool of shared experience that can influence other people's pain. So, like, just because something is subjective and locked away in your head, and there's no sort of, like, shared reference point, you know, that's one of the things that kind of makes us who we are, is that we have. I have another thing that I wrote down here, I think in the Goldman article, strata of commonality. Like, that's my own sort of digestion of what Goldman's, you know, talking about, where you have layers of things that kind of bridge subjective experiences of reality, including shared language, you know, and, you know, shared brain structure and culture that allow us to connect across otherwise completely isolated, unshared experiences. So I kind of was sort of mystified, by Zemok's point, and maybe I missed a later point where he addresses this, that, like, you know, you can't, you know, effectively communicate about a subjective and entirely subjective experience, because that seems like,
well, he
pretty bullshit,
right? Like, I see what you're saying. One difference he does point out, though, so when people feel pain, we have the same outward behaviors or very similar outward behaviors. So when I'm in pain, like I stub my toe and I'm like, oh, fuck. Or, you know, I scream or I cry or whatever. So we can infer that when somebody else stubs their toe and has the same outward behavior, that they're also experiencing the same internal thing. So that's why Zemok thinks that pain, we know pain can is referencing the same internal subject.
Oh, or, yeah. Or, I'm kind of getting them mixed up, right. I think.
No, that's fine. But then because we don't have any outward behaviors, when we see something that is gaudy, like our outward behaviors, there's no way that every human reacts when they see something gaudy. Meaning, if there's no outward behavior and we only have our subjective experiences of gaudy, we couldn't actually talk about gaudiness unless it actually existed, is what Zemok is saying. Like, that's the upshot of his argument.
I guess
does that make sense?
The flaw there, as it seems to me, is that, like, even if gaudiness is a learned cultural construct, which, mm-hmm. I mean, gaudiness in particular probably is, that's kind of a, you know, I think some aesthetic properties or responses are subjectively, without, you know, retreating to the philosophy, my intuitive sense is that some subjective ideas, properties, evaluative things are more or less culturally learned versus at least somewhat innate, right? But, like, if gaudiness is entirely a learned social construct, that doesn't mean we can't talk about it. Like, if we only know gaudy from having been told, well, XYZ symphonies are gaudy symphonies, that still means you can hear a fourth symphony and tell whether or not it has properties that align with the three that you've been told are gaudy and discuss whether or not it's gaudy. That, I mean, it might be that maybe we're all a little bit squishy in our precise sense of what gaudy means, or there's some play in the joints or some variation, but fundamentally, like, I guess, like, the idea that something is, the idea that the terms are maybe referencing something that is learned and cultural rather than innate and you know,
right.
Kind of the idea that you can't talk about a thing unless it is somehow universal just seem, I just don't, I mean,
is probably not true.
It's probably, yeah, not true, right? Like, I don't right. find that argument, like, it just seems really transparently unpersuasive.
Yeah, that I didn't think about that when I was reading this, but that does make sense to me, because it certainly seems like we could, a cultural response to certain properties could be, you know, quote unquote gaudiness, right? Like, our response is that it's gaudy, and then when you're kind of indoctrinated is probably too strong a word, inculcated into that society, you would internalize the properties that correspond with gaudiness, and the
right.
properties themselves would be real, but not necessarily the aesthetic property of gaudiness.
Right.
Or maybe it would be real, but it would be culturally relative, which would be more towards Goldman's side, right? Like the relativist or the anti-realist. That makes sense.
So in hearing you talk, like, the empirical and into the evaluative, is that sort of like you know, Hans mentioned a symphony that, you know, has a particular quality. It can be evaluated for a particular quality, and you sort of model that evaluation. But it, like jumping to like visual arts, I think that might be like kind of easy to talk about. You know, Jackson Pollock has like a bunch of colors, a bunch of shit going on. So you can say like sort of like empirically that there's a bunch of colors and a bunch of, you know, sort of like noise on the canvas.
And I think noise is evaluatively loaded.
Yeah.
There's a great deal of data on the canvas, maybe.
Yeah. Right. So, but then when you, I think you're right. Like when I started to say noise, or if I were to say busyness, or if I were to say it is chaotic, then you are drifting away from that empirical sort of like measure and into an evaluative measure. And then the question is whether that evaluative measure has some sort of transcendental, like sort of objective, like existence, or it has something that it exists between us that is real, or did we construct it and therefore it's liquid and can go in any direction. I guess I'm sort of jumping ahead. I think Hans hit the nail on the head with the idea, the kind of, I guess, rhetorical thing that that Zemach does to kind of say that, like, well, if there wasn't something there, we couldn't talk about it. I think that premise is like fundamentally flawed.
Sure.
You know, and so
Batman doesn't exist, but we can talk about Batman. And Batman could be anything, but we can still talk about what Batman might be, you know.
I would just respond to what you said, Hans, with actually a reference to one of the articles we read way back in the day, the last time I chose like a philosophical aesthetic topic, where I was like, Truth in Literature. Do you guys remember that podcast? Mm-hmm. One article we read for that pointed out that fictional characters do have existence. It's just not the same kind of existence as human beings in the corporeal world. They have, you know, existence, you know, they exist in our minds. They exist fictionally, and the specific example given was Hamlet.
Does godliness exist fictionally then? Is godliness actually kind of in the same realm of concept as Batman or Hamlet?
Maybe. I'm not sure. It seems like, you know, we're talking about Zemach, and we don't, even if we're sympathetic, we don't necessarily think that Zemach's got great arguments. I don't think that Goldman necessarily has great arguments either. And I wanted to talk about one thing he says on page 37, which is the last page of his article. He says, there is one final concession to be made to the realist. Having noted that the truth of aesthetic judgments is relative to differing tastes, an aesthetic judgment is true with an ideal critic with taste extrapolated from that of the actual judge respond to an objective properties of the artwork in a similar way, yada, yada, yada. He then says, we must also recognize that tastes can improve. So I would challenge Goldman to explain how aesthetic tastes can improve without referencing any normative aesthetics, meaning, so So normative means should we or should we not do something? And so normative aesthetics in the realm of aesthetics. Are there things that good artists should or should not do? Are there things good critics should or should not see? So I would challenge Goldman to point out a way in which tastes can improve without referencing like this objective idea of normative aesthetics. And so my point here is, so let's say he says something, he responds in a way that you did, Hans, where you're like, well, the evaluations, aesthetic evaluations are relative to a culture. That's something that you pointed out, Hans. Yeah, now, I'm not saying that you say every aesthetic evaluation is relative to a culture, but you did say, like,
there's a
gaudiness
sure,
could
yeah,
be.
Yeah.
Right. Gaudiness could be culturally learned, right? So if that is the case, then I don't see how tastes can improve, right? At least not to an ideal observer. There wouldn't be an ideal observer. Taste would only improve within a cultural context. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And maybe that's all Goldman is saying.
Yeah, what is the distinction? But what would it look like for a taste to improve along a non-cultural context? Because like, if we think about,
well,
you know,
it would,
if we think about like religion, say, you know, it's a constructed sort of doctrine that might or might not be have any objective reality to it, but you can certainly climb the ranks of a, you know, of a religious institution and mm-hmm. become, you know, you could improve in the eyes of the Lord, whether
sure.
you are improving along any objective measure or not. And so, like, I guess what would it look like for someone's tastes to improve in an objective measure? And is that distinct from improving, like, in a, you know, along a cultural measure?
I think to some extent, like, you're right that that's a flaw in Goldman's argument, right?
Right.
You presented it as a challenge, Patrick. I don't necessarily know that there's a great answer to that challenge, right? Allowing that possibility, I think, does to some extent probably imply the belief in some amount of something that goes beyond just complete subjectivity of internal response. I guess you could argue that, like, so we talked a little bit about like the empirical property of the artwork and then drawing an evaluative response from that, right? If you are better able to understand the empirical properties of the artwork, maybe that gives you a better range of possibilities for aesthetic response. Like if you, mm-hmm. you know, if you understand the difference between 4/4 and an odd time signature, then if you hear a song in an odd time signature, you can go, ah, there's a layer of distinction here in the rhythmic quality of this song. Whereas someone who doesn't understand that property might not recognize, you know, if two people hear Salisbury Hill and one of them knows that the verse is in 7/4, then they can go, oh, there's an aspect of creativity and complexity here that I am aware of that another listener might not be. So you have maybe like the better you can understand the empirical quality of something, the greater range of experiences you can have in subjectively responding to it, the just greater amount of subjective experience you will have, perhaps, which might be improving taste to the extent that it improves the experience of, it improves just the amount of feeling and thought that you might have while experiencing the music.
Sure. That makes sense.
I think too the history of the form or the medium can develop its own kind of empirical texture. So like jazz is decades and decades of musicians citing or alluding to each other's work. Is that an empirical connection though, or a subjective one? I think it must have an empirical foundation to it. You know, it's like, well, like sure. you're doing a particular note sequence, or you're doing a particular, you know, time signature or something. And so there is maybe a shared objective root there. Sorry, Patrick, you were saying something.
Well, all I was going to say is that it seems like we, in the way that we're talking, we're recognizing that a work has certain empirical qualities, such as time signature, you know, beats per minute, you know, it has three verses and two choruses, or this poem has 14 lines, the last two of which form a couplet, right? Like these are empirical qualities, but where we start to stumble is the evaluative side, where we say, is any of this good or bad? So we could even like refer to something more general, like what Zemach pointed out in his comparison to scientific realism. He talked about simplicity, right? Like a simple narrative would be something like Mother Night by Kurt Vonnegut, and a more complex and less simple narrative would be something like Omen Setter's Luck by Gass. Is that his name, Gass?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, we have empirical qualities that we can talk about, but I'm not sure we're getting to any point where we can say that empirical qualities are good or bad.
No, I don't think we are. I don't think we are. I mean, I think and I think we are mainly talking about, I believe, talking about empirical qualities in relationship to the improvement of taste, right? You could argue, if you wanted to be relatively objective, you could argue maybe that greater understanding of empirical qualities, Jesus, I keep calling it that, greater understanding of empirical qualities just improves the space in which subjective experience can be had, thereby allowing,
right,
just for like a greater quantity of taste, essentially. You can be thinking about, right, feeling, right, 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 responding to more things. You have a greater amount of thought and feeling, even if the thoughts and feelings are not tied to any property that might be universally applicable.
Right, right, right. Interesting. Man, I like, I'm not sure where this leaves me personally, just because I feel like I would like to believe in the reality of aesthetic properties, but like if
why would you like to?
I would like to because I feel that if there can be real evaluations of whether a work is good or bad, then our discussions about aesthetics are relevant and important. If there are no real aesthetic properties, then our discussions are pointless.
Well, I mean, like, okay, so a follow-up. Why is it pointless if we're not working toward a
no
objective reality?
There would be no truth about whether Shakespeare is a good or bad writer. He's just a writer that lived and did things. And yes, he had a huge effect on the English-speaking world in that his works are acclaimed, and many of his patterns of speech and turns of phrases have kind of, you know, seeped into our nomenclature. But it seems it would be sad for me. I would be sad. This is actually funny. I would be sad if there were no truth of the matter about whether or not Shakespeare were a good writer. And this was actually something that, what was that guy's name? I think it was Deleuze, who said that the purpose of philosophy is to sadden. The purpose is to make you face the truth. And I mean, I guess if that's the truth, that's the truth. But don't you think you'd be a little bummed out if it turned out that Shakespeare were not a good writer? Or, I mean, by the implications of that statement, maybe not Shakespeare specifically.
I guess I don't buy the implications of the, you know, I think that, you know, I'm not sure, does this make me a phenomenologist? You would know better than me, Patrick, but like simply the truth that the empirical truth that, you know, Shakespeare's work has influenced, you know, generations and has been the seed crystal for so much more work, that is an empirical measure of his greatness, you know. So like,
so he's objectively good. Is that what you're saying?
I think that objective goodness is complicated because, like, so he is objectively influential, and then within that influence is recognized as good. So I don't know what we lose if we ditch the need to sort of
the term objective.
If we ditch the yardstick of good versus bad, without, I guess, like a human observer, or like a kind of, you know, I think that like if we're working from sort of like a place of observation, where observation and evaluation make real the, you know, sort of in sort of collective consciousness, the kind of consistent evaluation of artists, especially great artists, you know, within that context that's created over time, and with, you know, lots of people engaging each other and talking about the qualities of Shakespeare, we create the yardstick that measures Shakespeare, but mostly measures other people against Shakespeare, you know, and then mm-hmm. and then that, you know, is the strata in which we make art and in which we, you know, evaluate art. And that is real, even if it is not objectively, you know, it has no objective basis. It's an entirely, it is a subjectively constructed context, if that makes sense.
Sure.
You were talking a moment ago, Patrick, about Mother Night, and I'm thinking about the conversation that we had about Mother Night, right? Where I went in with one idea of it that was somewhat critical and reductive, and you made, I think, a pretty effective point about how I was missing depths that it had thematically, right? And mm-hmm. I found that to be a very enjoyable and stimulating and worthwhile experience. And certainly, you know, a better one than I would have had simply reading the novel on my own. And so if your concern is that you're worried that discussions about aesthetic experiences might be valueless, I think my own lived experience suggests that they are not valueless. And obviously lived experience, it's easy to privilege that too much, I suppose. But if one were to make a philosophical argument that led to the conclusion that discussing aesthetics is valueless unless we can definitively prove that aesthetic properties exist in the same subjective way that gravity does, I would resist that because it is just clearly contrary to direct experience, just as much as any other philosophical argument that led to something that was just in a, you know, real world way, profoundly not true, right? I do think that, so here's, as far as the question of like the universality of aesthetics, right? Like the idea that I'll tell you the idea that I had going into these readings, and I'll admit that this idea has not been in any way swayed, deepened, or changed by the readings, which I don't know if that's a problem with me, but
so this is an idea you had before the readings and it's one you still hold.
This remains my belief, right? Here's what I think.
Okay.
I think that there are a certain number of responses that we have to art that are in some way innate and transcend culture, right? I think that if you took somebody who, you know, a tribes person who lived deep in the jungles of Brazil, who had no knowledge of Western music or Western art, and you gave them a Jackson Pollock painting and a painting that was just like, you know, one of those very minimalist, just like a giant square of blue, right? And asked them to talk about the feelings that they had looking at it. I think that the Pollock would feel chaotic and stressful to them as an aesthetic experience, and the big patch of blue would feel soothing. And I think that kind of basic response, I don't think that you need Western art training to have that response, right? Or if you, you know, if you played them, I don't know, Threnody for the Victims of Hiroshima by Penderecki, right? Like this incredibly chaotic, atonal, dense classical piece, modern experimental classical piece, and then you played them an Adele song and you said, you know, which of these is prettier to you? I don't think that it would be a flip of a coin whether they liked the Penderecki or the Adele, right? Like that's
sure.
Maybe I'm wrong. I you know, like this is based on intuition, but I suspect that they would probably like the Adele more, right? So I do think that there are somewhat innate responses that transcend culture, right? And I think what you have in an aesthetic experience, you have the empirical properties of the thing. You have the innate responses that transcend culture. You have the culturally learned responses, and you have the inscrutable selfhood that you bring to all that stuff, right? Your memories and your experiences and your associations and just kind of the alchemy of you. And what happens in aesthetics is the interaction between those four things, and that is sacred to me in a way, right? The mystery of the interaction between the empirical thing, the innate response, the cultured response, and the individual response. Like the blending of those qualities into an individual experience is essentially infinite. It's infinitely renewable. It's infinitely textured. It's an infinitely beautiful characteristic of consciousness. And that is beautiful and sacred to me. And trying to strike one of those things from that formula is kind of an abomination to me. And I would regard in that sense both of these articles as kind of an abomination. Even though I think Goldman actually kind of ends up not too far away from the perspective I laid out just now, you know?
Okay. That's awesome. Like, there's a lot to think about, and I think the idea that at the very least, the idea that artistic objects have aesthetic power and cause us to have strong emotions and are cause us to have important enlightening discussions with one another and serve as the nexus of, you know, for our community of three people, for example, like that's a positive thing, right? So I'm willing to suspend judgment on the question of aesthetic realism versus anti-realism and just say that regardless of the answer, the discussions are absolutely worth it. And like what you said, Hans, about like your own personal responses along with the cultural response and everything, all four viewpoints kind of put together are sacred in a way. So I definitely like that and find that to be a valuable position, and almost got a lump in my throat, to be honest, the way you talked about it. So that we don't leave out LFO, like I'd like to move on to talking about LFO if Definitely. That sounds cool to you.
Sure.
All right, cool. So let's just you know, suspending judgment on aesthetic realism versus anti-realism, let's just go back to the idea of artistic worth or artistic merit. Does LFO have any positive artistic merit?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So one of your questions was a calculus for artistic worth, right?
Right.
If we assume that there can be a calculus for artistic worth, I'm going to offer off the top of my head a calculus for artistic worth for film, and apply it to
LFO. Film, okay.
Here's my calculus of artistic worth for.
Hold on. Let's get DMX and Marilyn Manson to feature on this. Go for it, buddy.
Too bad. Too bad our audience won't get that joke.
I think that
because that
was a great callback.
We weren't. It was a great callback, though.
I think that, like, film is a very interesting medium because it's the most resource-intensive artistic medium that has ever existed, right? Like, film inevitably, because films take, depending on the film, somewhere between $1,000 and $100 million to create. I think film is very, very, very difficult to detach from the understanding of the process of creation, right? Because film inevitably, the creation of a film first and foremost involves, even for a very small film, marshaling resources, right? And so I think if I had to come up with a reasonably objective calculus for artistic worth for film, I would maybe start with the ratio between, I would maybe start with like use of resources, right? You have a certain amount of resources that go into a film. How well are those resources turned into something interesting, distinct, enjoyable, worthwhile? And I think that LFO, it's a film that is made with, by most standards, very minimal resources and very, very interesting and impressive things are done with those minimal resources. And so off the top of my head, by that one calculus, I think it's a very good movie.
I'll add to that another dimension. And maybe there's a model here. Like you create different yardsticks, whether those yardsticks have any sort of objective basis, but everyone sort of talking about the artwork can sort of agree that the yardstick, it has merit, and that, if you can come to some kind of like consistent agreement with where art scores on those yardsticks, then you have, a sort of shared understanding, whether that's objective or not. And another dimension I'd add to Hans's is the way in which, different emotional responses can be sort of crammed together, especially ones that don't normally go together, and how that can manifest in really interesting, compelling experience. So like LFO is, you said horror comedy. I definitely found it really funny. I cracked up when Kraftwerk, got decided at the end. What was it? The president's inauguration. Kraftwerk is going to play at the president's inauguration. I think LFO does a good job of making you feel confused about what you should be feeling in a way that's energizing and engaging. You know, so like it is horrifying, but it is really fucking funny at the same time. And I think that that is, you know, something that you can do that artwork actively tries to do, you know, film or novels or whatever, and many fail at, and LFO does it very well. That is one of my favorite things, when I feel like I can't tell whether like I want to like hide, you know, like you know, not look at the screen or bust up laughing. So
sure.
Yeah.
The articles we read kind of had a few different words for aesthetic properties: beauty, simplicity, gaudiness, daintiness, sublimity, and some others. What aesthetic properties, if any of those or any others, would you use to describe the film LFO? Beautiful?
Probably
gaudy?
Not beautiful. Simple? It's a very simple movie, I think.
Yeah.
In its construction, at least, right? Like, it's not...
Right.
Well, there are complex things about it, I guess, right? Like, the relationship with the wife and the way that we come to understand that she's a ghost, essentially, right? Like,
right.
That's... It's in some ways a complicated story, but it's being relayed using a pretty minimal set of sets, of props, of, you know, a very small cast, very limited number of locations. So it's got an interesting relationship between simplicity of form and complexity of narrative, maybe.
Right. Yeah, I definitely think simplicity is pretty good. Like, is a pretty good word. Are there any shots outside of our protagonist's house? Don't all the shots take place within the kitchen, the living room, the basement?
I think so. Yeah, I don't think we even go to like the driveway.
Yeah.
Right. We do. Everything is within the house. Like, we see onto the neighbor's house a little bit, and like we'll see the neighbor husband. I forget all three of their names, which is all the characters' names for some reason. Maybe because it's in Swedish, the neighbor's husband, we see him outside cleaning windows, but really, so simple set. It does kind of the thing that they tell you to do in basic screenwriting, which is, you have to, if there's anything you want us to know about your character, you kind of have to do it through dialogue. So, like, in the early scenes, we see our protagonist down in the basement talking to some people in his chat group or in his synthesizer, online synthesizer groups about, like, finding out that LFO frequencies collide. And then we move on to him, like, figuring out that the LFO frequencies kind of induce a receptive hypnotic state. And then later we see him on the chat again saying, oh, it was, we were just barking up the wrong tree with his friends. You know, like, it doesn't do it. I thought that was funny. Like, oh no, this doesn't do anything. don't do this. So I thought that was humorous. So I guess humor is an aesthetic property that the film has. I would say gaudiness seems to be, like, it seems gaudy in places, or maybe even beyond gaudiness into, like, grotesquery, right? Like, it's pretty grotesque when, like, he is hypnotizing the neighbor woman so that she'll just lay there while he has sex with her. But, you know, essentially R-ing her. I don't know. When did we start bleeping rape? When did we?
I don't think I ever started doing that. It's probably a social.
When did I
think that, like, we as a larger group started doing it during TikTok, right? Because, like, you want to bleep words that might. The algorithm is going to downrate you if it thinks you have rape content.
Right.
So I think, like, so the kill, I think, is censored for that reason too. Right. Like, you'll see, like,
right,
K1
like you say unalive
LL,
someone.
Whatever.
Yeah. Unalive someone or murked someone.
Right.
Oh yeah. So we move into grotesquery there. Was there a particular property that you two enjoyed from the film?
This is a property that would probably only apply to narrative artwork, but predictability versus unpredictability, right? Like at the beginning of the story, do you have a sense of what the end point of the story will be and how we'll get to that end point, right? And I think that's almost that borders on being a truly objective property, I think, really, right? Because you could, like, play someone the first 15 minutes of a film and say, tell me everything that you think will happen in the remainder of this film, and just, like, you know, rate whether or not they were able to do that with 100 people and rate whether or not they can work that out, right? And, you know, if you play 100 people a rom-com and you say, you know, what will be the end point of this film? And you play 100 people LFO and say, what will be the end point of this film after 15 minutes, right? Like, I think the conclusion that the film reaches is truly surprising. Like, I think this is going to happen. It's truly surprising.
That was something I loved about my first watch. I was like, what the fuck is going to happen? You know, it's just like, what is happening here?
It's truly
Where is
surprising.
This gonna go? Yeah.
It's truly surprising in a way that is not, doesn't seem dissonant or jarring with what's been established already. I think, like, really good plotting combines surprise and inevitability, you know, and it does that very well, probably as well as any movie I can think of.
Agreed. Especially, I think, the fact that his wife is a hallucination, the last 10 minutes of the film, there is a kind of looseness, you know, even if it's, like, really kind of, like, tightly observed, like, we're still in his house for the entire movie. It feels like there's a kind of a quality of narrative tightness where everything happens in a very kind of plotted, scripted way that feels like a cookie cutter thing, like a canned thing. And then I don't know how to describe it other than looseness, and LFO is an example of that. It feels really surprising where we end up and how quickly, especially those last 10 minutes, we get there.
Yeah,
so
yeah, like it.
I really appreciate that too.
Yeah. Okay. I think that kind of gets us to a place where I feel like we have discussed most of what I wanted to discuss. I actually admit coming into this with a stronger sense that aesthetic realism is true than coming out of it. Like, I was not persuaded by Goldman. I agree that Zemeck's arguments weren't super solid, but I thought Goldman didn't have a strong case either. So my thought was, well, I probably lean towards aesthetic realism, and Zemeck wasn't that great, but Goldman to me seemed like he had to be a realist anyway. Like if you're gonna say something like tastes can improve, to me it seems like there's no way to do that without pointing out real aesthetic properties. But then we kind of talk some more, and I felt like coming up distinguishing between like empirical aspects of a work versus our evaluations, that's where I started to feel like maybe aesthetic realism maybe isn't as on solid ground as I thought it was. So there were definitely some like this all I'm saying is this discussion was valuable in a number of ways. Thank you, fellas. Was there more that either one of you wanted to say about anything?
Yeah, I think I'm good.
All right. Okay. So what's up next then, Chris? What are we doing?
Are you guys up for House of Leaves?
Sure.
All right.
Why wouldn't we be?
I feel like Hans, you've talked about it. I've never read it. It's been on my list for a while, and I know that you've talked about it in the past. So, and it's one of those that I was kind of just looking at a list of books that I feel like I should read, and that's been on the list for a long time.
All right, cool.
Awesome.
All right. Thank you, listeners, for tuning in. This has been a discussion of aesthetic properties and the film LFO. I hope you've enjoyed our discussion and found it enlightening as I did. Looks like next time we're going to be reading House of Leaves. It's a famous book. I totally forget the author's name.
Daniel Lewski.
Daniel Lewski. Okay. Cool. All right. Peace out, listeners. Have a good one.